It is Friday, December 27th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Theater Squared's new stage adaptation of A Christmas Carol will host performances now through December 29th at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studios. Dickens' classic tale of redemption, Ebenezer Scrooge and the Ghost That Haunt His Bedchamber, is reimagined for Northwest Arkansas audiences in this new production. Tickets and more information available at theater2.org or 443-5600. On this edition of Ozarks, we'll hear some of the voices we lost in 2013. In a few moments, we'll hear again an interview with writer Bill Harrison, conducted for Ozarks at Large more than 20 years ago. He'll talk about writing here and about writing in Los Angeles.
Well, you're overpaid to take orders and to write scripts that are embellished upon by producers' girlfriends, secretaries, stuntmen. Whoever has the thought of the day becomes a part of your work. So it's you have to put your ego in your pocket and take a deep breath and work.
We'll hear the entire interview for the first time in over two decades in just a bit on this edition of Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. Ivan Denton died this year after a lifetime of wood carving, writing, and having adventures. In February 1991, he came to our old studio on Dixon Street to talk about a book he'd just written that detailed a journey he made across the country. Old Brands and Lost Trails, Arkansas and the Great Cattle Drives was the name of the book. He had saddled up his favorite horse, Lad, and rode old cattle trails from his western Arkansas home to California. This is a small portion of our conversation about that experience.
Funny thing, when I rode across the border into Kansas, there was tornado warnings, and I stayed in a strong barn that night. And the next day, the wind switched to the north, like it'll do sometimes after tornado conditions. And I was riding hard into a headwind. And by then, I got to feel the trail. I knew it was going to be fairly easy. Just keep your horse headed the right direction, you're going to get there. So some kind of tensions and doubts broke loose, and I was just riding along into the wind, laughing like a maniac, telling Lad, hey, it's just a big joke, you know, it's not hard. And then after I was halfway there, like central Wyoming, it put the earth back into perspective. Now, this may surprise you. We say fast transportation makes the earth seem smaller. It makes it larger. It makes it seem bigger. My wife said she cried driving over the road thinking he couldn't have rode Lad this far. Well, you fly from here to California 500 miles an hour. You look down and say, how'd the pioneers ever do it? But when you do it, you say, hey, this ain't hard. We just plop, plop, plop on our little hooves and we get there. You know, it's easy. It's really easy. And so all of a sudden, the earth don't seem so big. Since I rode it, it seems much smaller from here to California. Hey, I can do that just on my little horse. You know, and it put the earth back into perspective.
Ivan Denton talking to me in the old KUAF building in February 1991. He was talking about the experiences that formed his second book, Old Brands and Lost Trails, Arkansas and the Great Cattle Drives. His first book, The Art of I. Denton, was published by the University of Arkansas Press in 1988 and is a wonderful collection of photographs of his wood carvings. Ivan Denton passed away earlier this year. We also lost another wonderful supporter of the arts this year, Dick Renko. Dick was a champion of music and often would come to Ozarks at Large in the 1990s to tell us about a great musician or band he was bringing to the area. For a time, he booked and curated the lineups for the Old Fort River Festival that took place for a few days each summer at Harry E. Kelly Park along the Arkansas River. He'd often come to our studio to talk about the many artists he'd booked for that weekend. He loved music, loved where he lived, and loved mixing the two together. When I was looking for a clip from one of our conversations to play a portion of for today's show, I discovered he never talked about himself during our conversations. He was so passionate about the music he was bringing to the region, he couldn't stop praising their talents. Over the course of the festival's existence, he brought to Fort Smith Emmylou Harris, Loudon Wainwright, Alison Krauss, and scores of others. And his voice, so deep and so warm, we would find reasons to have him come to the studio just so we can include his voice on Ozarks at Large. Here he is talking about, of course, music with former Ozarks at Large producer Jennifer Fulford on a June 1997 edition of Ozarks at Large.
I'm real excited about Sonny Burgess, an Arkansas native from Newport, Arkansas, who in the 50s was inspired by Elvis Presley, went down to Sun Recording Studios, Sam Phillips in Memphis. Sam told him to go back home and practice, and a year later he came back, and he got a record deal. And his contemporaries are Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash, and he knew all those guys and performed with them, and they all traded licks with each other. And he's just a fantastic guy. He's 65 years old.
And has he ever quit performing?
For a short time in the 70s, he did stop performing, but he couldn't quit. He just couldn't, and he's back into it. And he's got a new album. And Oscar Lopez, this nylon string guitarist from Chile, who lives in Vancouver now, and he is very flamboyant and very, very dramatic in his playing and his performance. So I'm very excited about these artists. And Paul Sebar and the Milwaukeeans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about their new album.
Sure. Their album is Upstroke, Down Folk, and it's a very eclectic mix of American roots, rhythm and blues, soul, funk, Latin rhythms, reggae influence. Paul's a real musicologist, and he's taken all these wonderful influences. He's a great band leader, and he's formed a great unit that just is extremely tight. Their vocals are fantastic, and they just lay down a great groove. Saxophone, great slide guitar. But this, most of all, it's this infectious groove that they really deliver, and that's why I'm excited about having them here. They've not played in this area much. They have only been to Arkansas one time. And when he was here recently, he said, I'd really like to go to Brinkley, Arkansas. And I said, really? Why? And he said, that's where Louis Jordan was born.
Dick Renko talking about the 1997 Old Fort River Festival with former Ozarks at Large producer Jennifer Fulford on a program that aired in June 1997. Dick passed away in the spring. We'll miss him greatly. In a moment, another voice quieted this year, writer Bill Harrison. He talked to Ozarks at Large in 1993, and we'll hear that conversation coming up next on Ozarks at Large. This fall, Bill Harrison passed away in Fayetteville. During his life, he wrote critically acclaimed novels, short stories, and screenplays. He helped create the University of Arkansas's Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing. And during his time at the University of Arkansas, he taught thousands of graduate and undergraduate students. His course on American film probably changed the way almost every student who took the class looked at movies. In September 1993, he talked to Ozarks at Large about writing. The interview was conducted by Rebecca Newth for a series on our program that was called Arkansas Voices. When Rebecca first pitched the idea for a series of interviews with writers, some who lived here and some who would visit, one of the names she had at the top of her wish list was Bill Harrison. This interview was recorded inside our studio at 747 West Dixon Street, and this is the first time we've aired it since its original air date of September 25th, 1993.
Well, I think being an only child, I was always telling stories to myself and my parents and my schoolmates, and it just happened.
Fairly early, or not until you got into college?
Well, always early, yeah. I even had a puppet show for the neighborhood children, and by the time I got to college and was a journalism major, I was busy with that. And as I also told you on the phone, I've never been an autobiographical writer. I've been a storyteller, and I guess the greatest vanity I have is that I can tell other people's stories often better than they can.
That would make you a valuable person. Do you like the Isaac Dennison stories then?
I like Out of Africa best, that memoir. And that's been a very influential book for me. It's one of my 10 favorite books.
It is?
Mm-hmm.
For the texture of Africa? Or?
No, just for the line-by-line observation. She's just a great camera in the world. And I think she's just so skilled at the kind of lyric composition.
Mm-hmm. I love that book, too. Well, you say that it's important for young writers to begin to think of themselves as writers. And I know you're co-founder of the MFA program here. And you said that, in an interview previously with Pam Carmel. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on that?
Well, coming to Arkansas, I'm a Texan, you know, and coming to Arkansas 30 years ago has just been so great because from the very beginning we began to attract grad students here who were talented, and I've always had talented students to work with. And sometimes I think the program here in Arkansas recruits well and takes credit for what very talented people do. But I... one of the great aspects of my life has been working with these kids, and well, not all kids, some in their 30s. We have applicants now with published books coming, wanting to get a degree and teach. And I think back on, you know, Barry Hanna and Lee Abbott and Ellen Gilchrist and so many others who've come through the program, and it's been a part of my life that's kept me again from being a self-absorbed writer. It's teaching is an unselfish activity, and although you may get to preen around a little bit, you usually in my line of work, it's down to a manuscript, editing, close work with a young author, and it takes one out of oneself. It's something, by the way, I like about film writing. It's work with others. It's like theater in that regard. And instead of becoming neurotic and self-absorbed, the writer in it works with others. It's quite different from writing novels or stories. I'd have to say the three great things in my life have been my family and the workshop students at Arkansas, and my work. And I can probably in about that order.
But I'm thinking about you now. Here, grew up in Michigan. It would never occur to me, well, I think I'll go stake out a certain continent.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to do it either. And it's also very pretentious to borrow people's lives. And to take on Burton and Speke, for example, the Victorian explorers who searched for the source of the Nile, as I did in the early 80s, that's sort of like somebody from Liverpool deciding to write about Jesse James. These are very well-known British figures. There's a monument to Speke in Hyde Park.
I missed it. I didn't see it.
Burton is one of the legendary figures of their literature. There have been 11 biographies about Burton, one about Speke. So it's somewhat pretentious to go get these people and write about them.
Well, I don't see how it's pretentious.
I thought I had a new angle. I thought no one had ever written about their real relationship. Speke was a well-known homosexual. He was also dyslexic. One of my sons is dyslexic, and I early picked up on that. I went to visit the Gerald Speke, his ancestor, his heir, rather, and all of their sons are dyslexic.
Oh.
And so we began to talk about the problems, learning disorders, and it was warm meeting with the family because they seemed to understand that I had sensed something that was true about their ancestor.
It seemed to permeate everything. Yeah.
Young Speke couldn't go to school, had to join the Indian Army. met up with Burton, wanted to shoot animals, and then finally became an explorer, though he was incapable of calculating where he had been and exactly what he had done. He made the right assertion. He did assert that, you know, Lake Victoria is the source of the Nile. It was a great book because there was lots of betrayal in the book and patterns of friendship and betrayal. And it was a book about what men are when they're at their best and worst, probably.
Yeah, both. Well, and I think he could have had more credit in his lifetime if he hadn't been dyslexic and if he had been able to write the maps up.
Mm-hmm. Possibly. That was a great book to write and to research. I think I liked the research, which is about 5 or 6 years of activity, as much as any writing. And I liked it, of course, as much as the book itself, and far, far better than the movie, which was always been a disappointment. But movies are sort of, capsules of books. Mm-hmm. They're sort of brochures based on books, and you're never really happy with those.
Well, since you brought it up then, I'll just, you said you might want to talk about what it's like to be an author out there in Los Angeles.
Well, you're overpaid to take orders and to write scripts that are embellished upon by producers' girlfriends, secretaries, stuntmen. Whoever has the thought of the day becomes a part of your work. So it's you have to put your ego in your pocket and take a deep breath and work. And sometimes it's fun. And if you have a particularly intelligent director, it could be exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea, of course, in a film is to take a script and then improve on it. The actor wants to improve on it. The director, theoretically. The cinematographer should have good ideas. And you get these layers of improvement, one hopes, instead of these black pages that blot out all the layers and obliterate the film finally and the ideas that one had going in.
Did you write the screenplay for Burton and Speak?
Mm-hmm. Not that they followed it. I wrote the screenplay for Rollerball, and the stuntmen wrote all the dialogue. And it's well known in town, I hate those two films. And I hope the next one, you know, maybe we get close to something I like.
And you said you've been doing one a year since about 1970.
Yeah, several for independent producers. An independent producer is someone who's not in the inner circles and not next to the studios and who has a little money and wants to risk it on a film. And when you take money as a screenwriter for independents and amateurs like that, you give it your very best. And some of the better scripts I've written, I think, are for people who didn't have the wherewithal eventually to get the film made. But
the money.
They paid me, and I was able to take off and write on my own and buy myself out of academic hock and work. And so the pleasure is twofold. I get time for myself, and I try to write a good script.
Technique in writing. You said all rules begin to bend and break as you tell a story. Well, in Three Hunters, there's a lot of, in the chapters, what I could only think of the word switchbacks. I was...
Flashbacks, yeah. The flashback chapters. Yeah.
I should know that.
Yeah.
Well, because I kept going ahead with the main storyline, but, you know, that was driving me ahead, but we were going back into... I just wondered if you comment
on... Well, those chapters... provide a backstory for the family. Every other chapter of 300 is a flashback chapter, and we go back to tales that and allowed me to lump in a lot of materials that I couldn't have used in the forward more dramatic story, where the leopard hunt. But when I go back, I can use the anecdotes, so I dumped a lot of things in, and I enjoyed many of those chapters more than the main story.
Yeah, because it's kind of a history of hunting in Africa,
and of that family,
isn't it?
Yeah, and of their trials with one another. They don't all get along all the time, and it's how they work their way through and out of these problems in the hunt that occupies the main story.
You mentioned the characterization as one of your main focal points, and that three hunters with the three or four people, of course a woman is a major person in that. The people are very complex. Again, how do you work through that? How do you...
Well, you start with a stereotype when you write, and then the next time your characters meet this person, you add a dimension. And the next time they meet him, you add another dimension. And finally, you're reading through layers of cellophane into the character, and he looks complex. But you begin with recognizable caricatures frequently when you write, and then you shade them off and give them other qualities. And it's like meeting people. We meet people, they're stereotypes, and we slowly know them.
They grow
for us. We didn't know they could play the piano. We didn't know they'd lost a child in their marriage. And we begin to understand more about them. And that technique can be taught and learned. It's one of the things we do in the workshops. We talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Burton and Speak, they are both such complex characters and real people. In real, you know, we're real people. Did you feel an obligation then in a different way because these were not...
These were historical characters, yeah. Well, I think I'm vain enough to think I got those historical characters better than anyone ever got them. There's a new biography of Burton called Sir Richard Francis Burton, and it's also a wonderful characterization of him, close to mine, I like to think. But I don't think anybody had ever understood many things about him, his marriage for one. His marriage to Isabel. So, yeah, I felt an obligation to get it historically right. And there were scenes I had in the book. No one could have been there. No one knew. But I thought I made an intelligent guess about what he might have said or done with Isabel, for example, in the bedroom or on that ship when they were alone or whatever. So I felt a lot of confidence writing it. And I'm gratified that the reviews in England and letters from people who have been Burton scholars have sort of proven me out and justified some of the leaps I took in that book.
There's something that just caught me about the book, the sadness and the way that people... We can't get along with each other, and
it's the tragedy of the book. It's Burton's a tragedy. He and his relationship to Speak was tragic, and I hope I got some of that. It's a serious book. Three Hunters very lighthearted in comparison.
Yeah,
and I've bounced back and forth all my career. Graham Greene makes distinctions between entertainments and real novels. I don't really make that distinction. I think some of your subjects are naturally lighter than others. I also think we all have very uneven careers. You don't reach a plateau where you're wonderfully intelligent and you write brilliantly and you're always a genius. I don't think Shakespeare had anything but an uneven career. I don't think Faulkner or Hemingway or any of our famous writers on either side of the Atlantic have had anything except very uneven careers. You're not always the same. When you're out, you write your best books, and you write books that probably you never should have conceived and written. And that's who we are. Mm-hmm. It's almost gratifying to know that Shakespeare wrote Titus Andronicus, which is like a Charles Bronson movie. it's wonderful to see that Hemingway could be so bad.
You have brought in a short story, a passage that you wanted to read, because I wanted to hear something that you were reading.
I stopped writing short stories in 1978, and I didn't resume until the 90s. And the story, I think, is for masters. Nabokov said anybody can write a novel, but it takes a master to write a short story. I'm not sure that that's not true. And I think I was stumped all those years. I wasn't thinking in short stories, but it's a quick action. This is set in South Africa. I'll just read a few paragraphs. And this is in the first person. This is only the second or third work I ever wrote in the first person. And you have to have a character. It's not you. It's somebody else. So this is a thief. And the name of the story is The Magician of Soweto. First I swiped this peach and ate it, and then I took a package of almonds and ate those while I shopped for my main course. This was in a supermarket on Wanderer Street, great name, right in the middle of Johannesburg, and the clerks were busy. My movements were unhurried. I was taking my time. Then this little guy starts following me around the aisles. He pretended to read the labels on things, but there he was, always behind me. What did I care? He was just another piece of dark background, a scrawny black guy who would get in trouble himself if he told anybody what I was doing. There was this barbecued chicken on the rotisserie, just like in some big supermarket back home, so I took that, and then I picked up some cheese, candy bars, everything went into my backpack, and this little guy was watching my talent, trying to see what my hands were doing, but I was too quick. After I finished, though, he was waiting for me outside. He had lots to say, but I was moving on down the sidewalk. It was a cool, breezy morning with a slight odor of cyanide in the air, the residue off those big mounds around town. In the old days, they used cyanide to leach the gold away from other minerals out of the mines. So now the wind blew it in the air, everyone getting his nose and eyes burned. Everybody sort of waiting around in the poison for things to get worse. This little guy fell into step with me, saying, "Work from EC and we'll make ourselves rich." I paid him no attention, but he kept on. "You're an American, aren't you? You look American, and my name is Moses Kawanda. I operate this stall in Soweto, but I plan to open my shop here in the city." He talked in questions. As we made our way toward the railway station, the stores got cheaper. After Woolworths came the used clothing outlets. "This new law," he went on, "it says a black man can open his own business in town, so the shop owners don't have to be white or Indian now. And why should the rest of us work out of open stalls in the townships? I know you've been sleeping outdoors," he went on, "because of how your jeans look, but the nights are getting cold. I know that too. So I have this room in the back of my shop. I signed a lease. And there's a bed, nothing fancy, so you can stay there while we get the items to sell." Well, it's two characters in a place, and it's, you know, that's what you do in the short story, I guess. Try to start off fast.
Bill Harrison died this fall. That interview, conducted by former Ozarks at Large interviewer Rebecca Newth, first aired on Ozarks at Large in September 1993. In about 7 minutes, we'll skip ahead a couple of decades to spend time on a remarkable mushroom farm with one of our favorite jacks of all trades, Curly Miller. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. It's Friday, December 27th, 2013. On this edition of Ozarks at Large, we're hearing again some of the voices we lost in 2013. This year, Charles Banks Wilson, an artist with a tremendous impact on art throughout the country, died. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas filed this story this summer.
Charles Banks Wilson, an American artist, was laid to rest on Tuesday in his hometown of Miami, Oklahoma. Born in Springdale in 1918, he maintained his ties to Arkansas throughout his 94 years as a painter, printmaker, teacher, lecturer, historian, magazine and book illustrator. He died in Rogers. The artist is most known for his paintings of American Indians. Wilson's works are housed in some of the most renowned museums and art galleries in the world, including New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art, Washington's Library of Congress, the Oklahoma State Capitol, where 4 13-feet tall and 27-feet wide murals line the rotunda. The Gilcrease Museum owns, according to the artist, over 300 pieces of his work. We here at Ozarks were lucky enough to speak with Wilson a number of times over the years. Excerpts you will hear in this report are from interviews conducted in 2006 and 2011.
The earliest memory I have was about when I was about tall enough to lay on my back and paint under my mother's kitchen table, because there was a great big white space, and that probably was my first mural. I used to draw on everything. But people would, when I got older, would say things like, gee, you have a lot of talent, or something like that. And I didn't know what they're talking about, because I thought everybody drew.
Not everyone does draw. Not like Wilson, who at 15 drew a portrait of Will Rogers. Growing up in Oklahoma, Wilson was surrounded by cowboys and Indians. As he grew into his career, he painted only what he called pureblood Indians, those that can trace their ancestry to only one tribe. The artist describes one of his works.
I think probably the best painting I ever did is this one behind you of the Indian. He was a pureblood Quapaw. That white decoration on his body would have extended on up the face, but I thought the face was just too good to clutter with that design, so I left it that way.
Wilson said he painted for himself, for fun. He described himself as an observer, a watcher, saying, I just came to watch. One of his paintings, owned by the Gilcrease, is titled Some Just Come to Watch. His success could be attributed to that characteristic. Documentarian Larry Foley produced a 30-minute film, Charles Banks, A Portrait of American Artist, in 2006. In an interview in that same year, he spoke of meeting that artist for the first time.
I met Charles, I believe it was in 2001, and I was doing some visual research for a documentary called The Forgotten Expedition. And I did a search, a little internet search, and lo and behold, I came upon an image called Osage Dreams by Charles Banks Wilson. And I went over and visited with him and was just captivated, not just by his art and his friendliness and his willingness to give me whatever I wanted, but the stories of his life. And I think I thought at that moment that this man has a story worth telling, and I'd like to tell it.
In making the film, Foley says he did what he teaches: tell the story the way it is. The film is his relationship with Wilson, intimate conversations with the artist. Foley's admiration for the man is quite evident.
Charles spent much of his life in Oklahoma, but he was born in Arkansas and he's lived back here since 1989, so he sort of belongs to all of us. He's just a robust character and one of the favorite subjects that I've ever covered in my entire career.
Wilson was 83 and 93, respectively, when the interviews were recorded. And understandably so. One can tell the artist was coming to terms with his career and his mortality.
If I could live it all over again, and I was just thinking the other day about them doing this program on my life in 30 minutes, and I actually have been drawing and painting for 72 years. How do you condense 72 years of career in 30 minutes? That'll shake you up. But, no, I'm very happy with what I've done. I'm afraid if I changed something, it wouldn't be the same, and I don't have any complaints at all.
For some reason, Wilson seemed concerned that the world, his public, might have a complaint, that they don't fully understand his work.
If I wanted to be remembered, I kind of wish that people would appreciate what I've done more than they do now.
Why do you feel that they don't now?
I don't know. I don't know that the now is particularly appropriate. I think I just think that people perhaps wouldn't understand. Maybe understand is a better word than appreciate and all that. Understand. Because I am essentially trying to say something. And you probably hope that people will understand what you're trying to say.
Charles Banks Wilson passed away May 2nd, 2013, in Rogers, Arkansas. The renowned artist painted for much of his 94 years. Wilson admitted to having painted approximately 150 different tribes of Native Americans. The excerpts of his and Larry Foley's voice were taken from interviews conducted for Ozarks at Large in 2006 and 2011.
Christina Thomas filed that story earlier this year for Ozarks at Large. A couple of years ago, my producing colleague Antoinette Grajeda and I traveled to the rural Ozarks for a tour of Sweden Creek Farms, a marvelous place where mushrooms are grown, then sent all over. Our guides were the owners, Carol Ann Rose and Curly Miller. They were wonderful hosts and took us all over the farm. They not only lived together and worked together, they played music together, too. More about that in a bit on this edition of Ozarks. Curly died this past July, but he left a tremendous legacy of spirited music, of community involvement, and love for his family and friends. Here is the story that came from our trip to Sweden Creek Farms in 2011. It takes a while to walk around the perimeter of Sweden Creek Farms. There, Carol Ann Rose and Curly Miller grow mushrooms, plenty of them, on their organic farm in remote Madison County. Those mushrooms grow on logs, rows and rows of logs.
We just fruit here in the summer. This group of logs here, you're not even looking at 5% of the logs that are on this place. Maybe not even that.
You've probably eaten some of their crop. They sell their shiitake mushrooms to restaurants and grocery stores in northwest Arkansas, but also to clients around the country. Every 2 weeks, more than a ton of mushrooms from Sweden Creek Farm are shipped out of Northwest Arkansas Regional Airport. The shiitakes are picked off the logs, the rows of logs, at different stages. Curly and Carol Ann call the largest ones barbecuers.
They're a large size, and then, like I said, some of them are smaller. We sort them separate for babies, and we sell them at Ozark Natural Foods. And also, at the Roots Festival, they're going to do a raw marinade that's going to have raw shiitakes and that have been marinated, and they're going to use babies for that.
Developing a successful mushroom farm isn't as easy as just taking shiitakes off a log. The crop grows under the bark, out of sight. Curly says a mushroom farmer has to make up stories about what he thinks is happening, then see if those stories are correct. Carol Ann and Curly say there are many potential complications. She says since the operation began in the 1980s, there's been plenty of trial and error. Sometimes expensive experiments in growing that provided education also hurt the bottom line. Weather, of course, can also be a factor, not just the usual concerns about extreme heat, cold, or drought that could stunt growth, but conditions developing half a continent away that can, and have, made the spawn of the mushroom emerge from log's bark too soon. 3 years ago, when the remnants of Hurricanes Gustav and Ike made it to the Ozarks, Sweden Creek Farm exploded with activity.
My best guess is 80,000 pounds in 2 days. The entire place blew.
Gustav's heavy rains and subsequent tropical conditions meant the mushroom spawn under the bark went on, as Curly describes it, a bender. Then, after Gustav, here came Ike.
Rained another 4 inches. The wind blew like crazy. It went down to like 42. And it shook. And another thing about shiitake is a branch can fall off a tree into a batch of bone-dry logs, and they'll fruit right where it hits them. From the shock of being jarred, yeah, they're really weird.
The back-to-back storms produced a year's worth of mushrooms almost overnight. Curly says the spore of the mushrooms could actually be seen floating up out of the hollow where the farm is located. Much of the impromptu crop was so large it couldn't be harvested. In the past 3 years, Curly and Carol Ann have figured out better ways to keep the shiitakes from fruiting too early. There is art, science, and a bit of intrigue involved in getting the right mushroom to grow in the right way. Over time, the methods at Sweden Creek have worked. And others, Carol Ann says, have noticed.
And there has been espionage. Where people have, you know, try to sneak on our farm and, you know, steal
county agents,
yeah. Stealing spawn, trying to recreate this. This is proprietary, and we're sworn to protect it and not give it out. And, you know, people have tried to steal it.
And that's why an important, pivotal part of the process at Sweden Creek is kept secret.
So this is where the real action is. This is... And this we don't share with anybody. We'll bring people in here, but we don't let anybody take pictures. We don't let anybody here who's an aspiring grower. We don't even have people on our farm because it always ends bad.
And so what happens down a dirt road some distance past the Kingston Square remains pretty much unrevealed to almost everybody. With or without trade secrets, mushrooms are an enigmatic harvest. Logs used as hosts can serve as fertile homes for a few generations of mushrooms before the nutrients are consumed by the spawn. Expired logs look fresh, but they weigh as little as a plastic wiffle ball bat.
All the nutrients and stuff, and see, you gotta... The other thing you have to remember is that this has been out in the woods for like 4 or 5 years, and the bark's still tight. The shiitake holds the bark right on. It's amazing, isn't it?
It really is.
Even a... This log has a lot of heartwood, so it would be heavier, but it'll make better firewood, but it still doesn't weigh that much. So this is our firewood for the winter.
Tired logs used for heating is just one example of how Carol Ann and Curly are resourceful. Curly works on the engines of the vans used for transporting the bounty. He poured concrete for one of the water tanks used to submerge the logs to invoke the mushrooms to fruit. Carol Ann manages gardens year-round that produce everything from corn to okra. They harvest watercress from the five springs on their land. As Curly explains, independent farmers miles away from a town cannot afford to not be sustainable. But he's never lost his passion. His eyes still grow wide with fascination when he takes a safety pin to a log that has minuscule fungal activity happening just under the surface.
See, here's another button coming right behind it. There's one right there happening. But that tomorrow they'll be... Oh, there's one right there. Tomorrow they'll all be pinned up. So they'll double, and then a whole bunch of them will pop the bark. And then in a couple of days, all those buttons will be emerged, and these will be picked out by probably about this time next week.
Curly and Carol Ann say the year-round care of the logs and the year-round physical moving of thousands of logs means the work is a combination of dairy farming and championship weightlifting. It's not an easy path for those mushrooms to get from the logs on this Madison County slice of land to the grocery store shelves or restaurant menu. But the farm seems ideal for the work, if you don't mind having to shoo a snake away once in a while.
Hey, get out of here.
Go on.
They got something.
There it is.
Come on.
Come on, get out of there. That looked cottonmouthish.
Yeah, it did.
The work at a mushroom farm like Sweden Creek is a mix of small labors and large, like the big tractors that haul logs along a pathway into the woods so they can rest and grow mushrooms. But spend a day with Curly and Carol Ann, and you get the feeling that these two transplants, he's from Rochester, New York, she's from New Jersey, have found the world that they love.
Oh, and this is the first place where we started growing. We had a big garden there. Actually, this is a big garden. It's grown up. It'll get taken care of. But
well, that was sweet corn. We already harvested
Yeah, we already harvested it. But we would be down here, you know, all summer picking mushrooms, stacking out logs, feeding kids watermelon in the, you know, in the fields, them playing and stuff, splashing in the creek, staying away from rattlers.
That story first aired 2 years ago on Ozarks at Large. Later that year, Curly, Carol Ann, and their bandmates Ray and Melanie Palmer, together they were the old 78s, came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio to talk about their then just released CD, The Women Wear No Clothes at All. They talked about the CD and played inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio.
The crux of it is we're trying to take this wonderful, a lot of what we're doing now is actually woodwind or brass band or like early jazz stuff, and we're just trying to put it on as many banjos as we can.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned downloading music. I'm sure the internet has made searching for century-old or older music easier. You've got a new technology that's helping you find music that was written more than 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's certainly I think there have always been catalogs of this kind of music and collections and libraries and things like that. But yeah, it's certainly much more accessible these days. That's really
to Paul. It's much more accessible to Paul, and then he puts it on CDs so that you know we can use our old technology to play it and learn it.
Paul and us have kind of
gone in the same musical direction together. What we started out playing mostly, you know, what people might call hillbilly fiddle tunes, but we kind of gravitated towards raggier stuff that was real prevalent, oddly enough, in Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, and particularly in East Texas, which was the kind of the founding point of like Texas swing, but it was like way pre-Texas swing. And then when we hooked up with Ray and Mel with this incredible jazz background and the possibility to expand it into a sound that was big enough to do this early jazz stuff, not where jazz that still had like a ragtime sort of melody. That's kind of where we're at right now. We're just kind of moving through all these different styles. And a lot of it is black music and jug band music, and it's just kind of fascinating. And we now have a chance to listen to everything.
Right. You know. Instantly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And people can find a lot of these songs on your new album, The Women Wear No Clothes at All. And I wanted to ask you, where did you come up with the name for your album?
Well, actually, Dr. Bill McNeil at the Ozark Folk Center put together a compilation called Somewhere in Arkansas. He was an unbelievable researcher and an unbelievable resource to a lot of us here in Arkansas. He passed away quite a few years ago, but he did produce this three CD collection, and I happened to read about it and got on the phone right away and ordered it, which was really quite lucky because they only produced, what, Curly, 200 copies?
Yes.
200 copies. But in that collection was this fabulous tune, The Women Wear No Clothes at All. And I think the words are, the women wear no clothes at all, the women wear no clothes at all, the women wear no clothes at all, but they get there just the same. And just from my research, it did seem like it was a combination of a couple of other tunes, and perhaps this older fellow didn't quite hear all the words, you know, as well as they could have been. There's another line, the women wear no Sunday shoes. And so shoes and clothes, you know, it could have gone together in his mind. But anyway, he sings that verse 7 times. So, go ahead, Curly.
He was 75 years old in 1927.
Ooh, so. Uh-huh.
When it was recorded, yeah. Mm-hmm. This tune we're going to play is called Beaver Slide Rag, and it was done by Peg Leg Howell and his gang in 1927. And it was on a CD, a compilation of African-American fiddle players called Violin Sings the Blues. 3, 4. Thank you.
old 78s inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio in late 2011. The players included Melanie and Ray Palmer, Carol Ann Rose, and the late Curly Miller. This summer, at the Fayetteville Roots Festival, Curly was honored posthumously with the first ever Crazy Chester Award, named after the character in the song The Wait by the band, for his devotion to community and music. This is Ozarks at Large.
That's Wayne Shorter from his 2013 CD, Without a Net. Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night beginning at 10 p.m. On this Friday edition of Shades of Jazz, I take a look back at the year 2013 with my top picks. Jazz releases that all occurred this last year, including Frank Wess, Nicholas Payton, Gary Burton, Bobby McFerrin, Wayne Shorter, Warren Wolf, and much, much more. Tune in this Friday and feast your ears to some of the greatest jazz from 2013.
Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. Theater Squared's new stage adaptation of A Christmas Carol will host performances through December 29th at Walton Art Center's Nadine Baum Studios. Dickens' classic tale of redemption, Ebenezer Scrooge and the Ghost That Haunt His Bedchamber, is reimagined for Northwest Arkansas audiences in this new production. Tickets and more information available at theater2.org or 443-5600. Christina Thomas will join me Sunday morning at 9 for the next edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large. Then all next week, during the daily Ozarks at Large programs, I'll be joined by not only Christina, but also Antoinette Grajeda, Katie Hendrickson, Timothy Dennis, and Jacqueline Froelich, as we'll talk about some of our favorite stories, interviews, musical performances, and more that aired on Ozarks at Large during 2013. That will begin Monday at noon, a full week, as is has become our tradition, of our favorite stories heard once again on Ozarks at Large. Then, a week from Sunday, on Weekend Ozarks at Large, that'd be January 5th, we'll hear some of our favorite musical performances from the past 6 months. That's all ahead on upcoming editions of Ozarks at Large and Weekend Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF, 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith,